Well, welcome to The Catholic Reason, a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, where we think through various claims made by the Catholic Church concerning issues of faith, morality, and culture, and provide reasons behind those claims. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers, and a member of the Chancery Evangelization Team here at the Diocese of Tulsa in Eastern Oklahoma. The Catholic Reason airs locally here in Tulsa every Thursday from 4 to 5 p.m. on St. Michael Catholic Radio 94.9 and 102.9, and across the entire Oklahoma Catholic Radio network of 15 different stations, including 97.3 FM in Oklahoma City, 100.9 in Edmond, and 88.3 FM in Lawton. But you may be listening at a different time on your own local Catholic station outside Oklahoma, since the Catholic Reason airs in other Catholic stations throughout the country. So regardless of where you're listening in from, a special welcome to you, and thanks for joining me today. Remember, you can download the show through whichever podcast platform that you use by subscribing to the Eastern Oklahoma Catholic Podcast. You can also access the archived episodes of The Catholic Reason at my website, CarloBroussard.com, under both the audio and video tab. In previous episodes, we gave positive evidence for the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. Such evidence involved Paul's teaching, say, in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 11 through 15, and principles in Scripture from which we can derive, by good and necessary consequence, the doctrine of purgatory. In today's episode, I'd like to look at a common Protestant challenge to purgatory. And that's the general argument that Scripture reveals the immediate entrance into heaven for a Christian whenever they die, which, if true, the doctrine of purgatory would contradict that biblical evidence. And there are several passages that Protestants appeal to for this argument, and we'll look at each in turn in today's episode. All the passages that I look at today come from the late Norman Geisler and Ralph McKenzie in their book, Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, Agreements and Differences. So let's go ahead and dive in and start with the first passage, very common passage, and that is Luke 23:43, where Jesus promises the good thief on the cross, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you will be with me in paradise." If heaven is given to the good thief on that day, so a Protestant will argue, but then there's no need for any sort of final purification. There is no room for any sort of postmortem final purification. Well, the first thing that we can say in response is that the challenge assumes that paradise, quote-unquote, is heaven. But that's not necessarily true. Paradise, in Greek paradisos, could be referring to the dwelling place of the righteous dead in a state of blessedness, which, at the time of Jesus' crucifixion, was not heaven yet, because Jesus had not ascended into heaven. This probably is the state of postmortem natural bliss before Jesus ascends into heaven for all the righteous souls is what is affectionately termed Abraham's bosom. The Catechism of the Catholic Church draws this distinction in paragraph 661 and 1023. And this probably is how the good thief would have understood Jesus' statement, "You'll be with me in paradise," given that he wasn't aware of any revelation concerning the Christian concept of quote-unquote heaven or the beatific vision. So the good thief would have been thinking paradise means Abraham's bosom, and we have good reason to think that's what Jesus meant as well, because he had not yet ascended to the Father. Such a place, Abraham's bosom, is also cashed out as a quote-unquote prison to which Jesus went after his death in order to preach to the spirits held there. St. Peter articulates this realm of the dead, this postmortem state of existence, as a quote-unquote prison in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 19. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church has some commentary on that in paragraph 633. So on that day, on the cross, when Jesus makes the promise or declares to the good thief that he'll be with him in his kingdom in paradise, Jesus may have been and most likely was promising the good thief to be with him in the abode of the dead, not heaven. in, as St. Peter puts it, the prison of the spirits. Or, as our Lord puts it in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, Abraham's bosom. So in that case, this verse of the good thief on the cross does not serve as a defeater of purgatory. It doesn't rule out the good thief's, or anyone else's for that matter, need for a final purification before entrance into heaven. Either A, the good thief would have received a final purification before entering into Abraham's bosom and experiencing that natural bliss, or B, being in Abraham's bosom, experiencing a natural bliss, but receiving some sort of final purification before entering into the beatific vision upon Christ's ascension into heaven. Okay, a second response here to the good thief on the cross example is, even if we say for argument's sake that Jesus was talking about heaven here when he spoke of quote-unquote paradise, so let's just grant that for argument's sake. And let's say, for argument's sake, the good thief was going to receive heaven on that day without a final purification. It still wouldn't disprove the existence of purgatory. As I explain in chapters 9 and 10 of my book, Purgatory is for Real, the church teaches that it's possible someone can have such a fervent degree of charity at death that such charity is sufficient to remit all guilt of venial sin and even satisfy for the temporal punishment due for sins that have been forgiven and thus bypass purgatory. The Catechism teaches this in paragraphs 1022 and 1472. And so the good thief may very well have been one of those people. Just an example of those who have such a fervent degree of charity such that they can bypass purgatory and go straight to heaven. Again, assuming for argument's sake that by paradise Jesus means heaven on that day. Moreover, the good thief was suffering on the cross for his crime. He was being justly punished for his crime and willed to embrace it. He voluntarily embraced it. According to Luke in chapter 23, verse 41, the good thief says, "We are receiving the due reward of our deeds." The good thief's suffering, therefore, could have been sufficient to free him from the temporal punishment due for his sin. And since Jesus has promised to be with him in paradise implies that his sins were forgiven, it's possible the good thief did not have to experience any post-mortem purification. And that fits perfectly within the theological paradigm of the Catholic theological paradigm that includes purgatory. Also, another response, consider that the duration of purgatory isn't measured by our solar time. Something else I talk about in chapter 10 of my book, Purgatory is for Real. So even if Jesus were referring to heaven here, and the good thief received it on that day, it still wouldn't follow that the good thief didn't have to go through a final purification after death. He could have experienced a purgation that was not defined in ordinary terms of duration and still entered in heaven on that day. It could have been instantaneous. As Paul says in reference to the bodily resurrection on the last day, we shall be changed in a moment in the twinkling of an eye. He writes that in 1 Corinthians 15:51-52. Time just doesn't work the same in the afterlife as it does in this life. So the idea here is, just as we will be changed in the twinkling of an eye in a moment, instantaneously, at the bodily resurrection, so too it's possible that at least for some souls, their quote-unquote change, their purification in purgatory, can be in the twinkling of an eye, in a moment, instantaneously. And given that possibility, even if the good thief received heaven on that day, it still wouldn't rule out a post-mortem final purification, because the purification could have been instantaneous subsequent to death, and he still received heaven on that day. Now, here's a fourth response to this challenge from the good thief on the cross. Notice how the challenge assumes that, quote-unquote, today refers to the time when the good thief will be with Jesus in paradise. And this is due to the punctuation in the English translation. Truly I say to you, truly, comma, I say to you, comma, today you will be with me in paradise. But there are no punctuation marks in the original Greek. So the passage could be read as, truly, comma, I say to you today, comma, you will be with me in paradise. On this reading, quote unquote, today, refers not to when the good thief will be with Jesus in paradise, but to when Jesus tells the good thief that he will be with him in paradise. That is an essentially different meaning than the former one. And if this latter meaning is what Jesus intended to say, well, then of course this passage would in no way serve as a defeater of the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. It would not in any way disprove purgatory. So, in conclusion, in our response to the good thief on the cross example, since there are plausible ways to read this passage other than an immediate entrance into heaven, and since an immediate entrance into heaven still coheres and is consistent with the doctrine of purgatory, it follows that this passage in no way undermines the Catholic belief in purgatory. So that completes our response to the first passage that's commonly appealed to, the good thief on the cross. Now, the second passage that's a common passage appealed to, again, to support the thesis that once a Christian dies, he immediately enters into heaven, thereby leaving no room for purgatory, is 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 6 through 8. And many will pose this challenge in the following manner, where St. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. For this objection, we're going to respond on the other side of the break. Stay tuned. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard. You're listening to The Catholic Reason. Welcome back, my friends, to The Catholic Reason. I'm Dr. Carlo Broussard. The Catholic Reason is a radio production of St. Michael Catholic Radio based here in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. And in today's episode, we're looking at a common challenge to the Catholic belief in purgatory, namely that the Bible reveals upon death a Christian immediately enters into heaven, thereby leaving no possibility or room for purgatory. And there are several different biblical passages that Protestants will appeal to. So far in today's episode, we've looked at only one, and that is the example of the good thief on the cross from Luke chapter 23, verse 43, where Jesus tells the good thief, "Today you will be with me in paradise." Now, as we answered in our first segment in response, we gave several responses, the first of which is that the challenge assumes paradise means heaven, but it's most likely the case that that is not what Jesus is referring to, but rather Abraham's bosom, as it's affectionately called among the Jews, that postmortem state of existence, neither heaven nor hell, that involves a natural bliss, where Lazarus went in the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke chapter 16. So if that's the case, and Jesus isn't even referring to heaven, well, then this passage couldn't possibly disprove purgatory, since the good thief, even though he goes to Abraham's bosom, could still experience some sort of final purification before entrance into heaven. And secondly, even if we concede for argument's sake that Jesus is referring to heaven here, the good thief may just simply be an exception to the norm of people going to purgatory, because in the Catholic system, theological system, it's possible for someone to have such a fervent degree of charity that they bypass purgatory and don't need it. So the good thief may very well have been one of those individuals, especially since the fact that he voluntarily embraces his suffering for his sins on the cross. A third response, again, assuming that Jesus is referring to heaven, still doesn't exclude purgatory, because the good thief's postmortem purification could very well have been instantaneous, and thereby still would be with Jesus in heaven on that day. And then finally, what Jesus is actually saying is a bit ambiguous. Given the punctuations or the lack thereof in the Greek, it's hard to discern whether Jesus is saying the good thief will be with him in paradise on that day, today you will be with me in paradise, or whether Jesus is saying to the good thief today that he will be with him in paradise. There's an essential difference in meaning there. So we've shown that Luke 23:43 does not serve to be a defeater of the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. Well, what about 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8? Many Protestants appeal to this passage and conclude that Paul is saying to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. Geisler and McKenzie argue that since the Bible says for a Christian to be away from the body is to be at home with the Lord, there can't be any intermediate state in the afterlife. So how might we respond to this challenge from 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8? And this is perhaps the most common passage that's appealed to. Protestants who appeal to this passage often fail to realize that Paul doesn't say to be away from the body is to be at home with the Lord. Paul simply says, quote, while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. That's obvious. And that, quote, we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. Notice he didn't say to be away from the body is to be at home with the Lord. It's an expression of a desire to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So it's important to point out exactly what Paul is saying here and not to let people think what Paul is saying, right? We want to be precise as to exactly what Paul is saying, and that will determine whether or not it can be used against purgatory. Now, our Protestant friends may reply that although Paul doesn't exactly say what the challenge claims, to be away from the body is to be present with the Lord, that's what he means. And let's just concede that for argument's sake. The question becomes, are they right? Is that what Paul intends to say with the language? Does the logic follow? Does the statement, we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord, does that mean the same as to be absent or away from the body is to be at home with the Lord? Well, I answer no. Suppose I'm at work and I'm wishing I could instead be away from work and at home with my wife and kids. Can we conclude from this that if I'm away from work, I must automatically be at home with my wife and kids? Doesn't seem like it. I could be away from work eating lunch at McDonald's or something. I don't eat at McDonald's, but anyway, it's just an example. I could be away from work on my way home, but sitting in traffic. That's a very high plausible situation. Not so much here in Tulsa, but when I used to live in California, absolutely so. So it's fallacious to conclude from this verse that once away from the body, a Christian must immediately be present with the Lord. So it's just some fallacious reasoning here in the appeal to 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8. So 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8 does not serve to be a defeater of the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. So what's another passage that Protestants appeal to? How about Philippians chapter 1, verse 23, which is very similar to what Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8. So here's what Paul says in Philippians 1, 23. Again, Geisler and McKenzie appeal to this passage as well in their books, Roman Catholics and Evangelicals Agreements and Differences. Quote, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better, close quote. So you can see the similarity with 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8. So in response, it's important that we first establish the context for what Paul is saying here. Paul's expressing a conflict that he's experiencing within himself because he writes, I'm hard pressed between the two there in verse 23. What are the two things that he's in conflict about? Well, he's torn between living and serving Christ on earth and being with Christ in heaven. In verses 22 through 23, he writes, for to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If it is to be life in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. Then in verses 24 through 25, he writes, but to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I shall remain and continue with you all. All Paul is saying here is that his desire is to serve Christ on earth. That all he's saying is that his desire to serve Christ on earth conflicts with his desire to be with Christ in heaven. Paul doesn't say this union takes place immediately after death, nor does the context suggest that he intends to say this in some implicit way. Again, he's just expressing, my desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is better. Better than what? Being here on earth serving Christ and the Christians. So he's just simply expressing a desire here, not that he will immediately be with the Lord whenever he dies. Now, a Protestant friend might object, you're just begging the question, Carlo. A Protestant friend might say, I'm arguing that Paul is saying that this union takes place immediately after death because he says, I desire to depart and be united with Christ. But as my good friend and colleague at Catholic Answers, Jimmy Akin, likes to point out, similar to our response in 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8, the conceptual unity that the two concepts have, departure from this life and union with Christ, doesn't mean they must be simultaneous in time. So again, even though there's a conceptual unity, depart from Christ and union with Christ, Paul's holding those two things, depart from this life and union with Christ, Paul is holding those two things conceptually together, that doesn't mean they must be simultaneous in reality or in time. Again, similar to what we saw in our response to 2 Corinthians 5, 6 through 8, there is a conceptual unity between being away from work and being at home with my family, when I was using that example. But that doesn't entail, as we saw, that both concepts are united in time, in reality, since I have to drive home. And I may even be impeded from quickly arriving at home due to a flat tire or to traffic or what have you. So just because Paul desires to depart and be with Christ, conceptual unity, that doesn't mean departing this life is simultaneous with being with Christ in heaven, a unity or simultaneity in time or in reality. Another colleague and good friend at Catholic Answers, Trent Horn, makes a great comparison to illustrate this point in his book, The Case for Catholicism. Consider 2 Corinthians 5:2, where Paul writes concerning our glorified bodies, here indeed we groan and long to put on our heavenly dwelling. If we were to follow the logic of the immediacy of heaven objection that we're considering here, we'd have to say that because Paul desires to die and have his glorified body after death, well, then Paul immediately gets his glorified body. But that's not true. We know from 1 Corinthians 15:52 that we're not going to get our glorified bodies, including Paul, until the future at the end of time. For as Paul speaks in verse 52 of 1 Corinthians 15 of the last trumpet. So the fact that Paul desires to have his glorified body after death doesn't mean that what he desires he immediately gets after death. Similarly, just because Paul desires to depart and be united with Christ in heaven, it doesn't follow that his union with Christ in heaven will be immediate. Therefore, the appeal to passages where Paul expresses his desire to depart from the body and be present with Christ, such as in 2 Corinthians 5:6-8 and Philippians 1:23, fails to undermine the Catholic belief in purgatory. Again, a mere expression of a desire for departure from this life and union with Christ in heaven does not logically entail departure from this life entails immediate presence with Christ in heaven. So 2 Corinthians 5:6-8 and Philippians 1:23 fail as arguments against the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. All right, my friends, on the other side of the break, we're going to pick back up with Hebrews 9:27, yet another passage appealed to in support of this thesis. Stay tuned. More to come on the other side. Well, welcome back, my friends, to The Catholic Reason. In today's episode, we're looking at the common challenge to the Catholic doctrine of purgatory that the Bible reveals upon death, a Christian immediately enters into heaven. And there is a slew of Bible passages that our Protestant brothers and sisters appeal to in support of this claim or thesis, one of which that we've looked at so far is the good thief on the cross, recorded in Luke chapter 23, verse 43, where our Lord promises him to be with him in paradise that day. And we gave some responses to that biblical passage, showing that that passage does not serve as a defeater of the Catholic doctrine of purgatory, or to state it differently, the Catholic doctrine of purgatory is not in conflict with that Bible passage. We also looked at a couple of passages that some Protestants appeal to prove that upon death, a Christian immediately enters into heaven. 2 Corinthians 5, 6-8 was one of the two, and the other was Philippians 1:23. And our general response to both of those passages is that the mere expression of a desire to be away, to depart this life and be united with Christ in heaven, does not logically entail departing this life for a Christian is immediate entrance or immediate union with Christ in heaven. And we gave some explanations and reasons why that is the case. Now, there are five more biblical passages that Protestants appeal to try and prove that upon death, a Christian immediately enters into heaven. And the so we're going to look at those five remaining passages in the remainder of today's episode. Now, these passages are appealed to in a rapid-fire manner by Norman Geisler and Ralph McKenzie, again, in their book, Roman Catholics and Evangelicals. They don't provide too much commentary, which tells us that they think, in appealing to these passages, that they are clear enough to justify the thesis that upon death, a Christian immediately enters into heaven. But as we'll see, this is not the case. And of course, Geisler and McKenzie tee up these five passages that we're going to look at by writing this: "The Bible speaks of death as the final moment of life after which one goes immediately to heaven or to hell." So they appeal to these passages not strictly for the Christian going immediately to heaven, but whether a Christian or the damned. So if you're damned, immediately into hell. If you're a Christian, immediately into heaven. So again, the fact that they don't provide much commentary for us to engage with signals to us that they thought these passages clearly demonstrate this immediate entrance into heaven for a Christian, or for the damned, immediately into hell. Now, as I mentioned before our last break, the first passage that they cite is Hebrews 9:27, where the author writes, "It's appointed that human beings die once, and after this, the judgment." Now, there are three ways that we can respond to this verse. First, or respond to this objection that appeals to this verse, to be more precise. First, the objection assumes that purgatory is an intermediate state between death and judgment. But this is not true. It's not necessarily the case. According to church teaching, the souls in purgatory have already, well, let me just say, I left open a loophole that's conceptually false. This is not the case, all right? Again, the assumption is that purgatory is an intermediate state between death and judgment, but this is not the case. According to church teaching, the souls in purgatory have already received their particular judgment. They know they are guaranteed heaven. This is why we believe and claim that the souls in purgatory have no possibility to go to hell. They are numbered among the elect. So they've already received their particular judgment. So that the author of Hebrews says we receive judgment after death doesn't negate purgatory, since purgatory is an experience of those who have already been judged to go to heaven. So you can see, hopefully you can see there, how Hebrews 9:27 on this account of what we actually teach about purgatory can in no way serve as a defeater. A second response is that Geisler and McKenzie beg the question against the Catholic. Notice the appeal to judgment for the Christian as evidence for immediate entrance into heaven. But they assume at the outset that judgment for the Christian means immediate entrance into heaven, which of course, it's just another way of saying that Christians immediately enter into heaven when they die. Thus, they're assuming the truth of immediate entrance into heaven to prove the conclusion that Christians immediately enter heaven after death. That's called begging the question or circular reasoning. So that's my second response. Now, a third response is that purgatory could be the judgment experience itself. Some theologians have articulated the purification of purgatory as taking place as Christ stands, as a Christian stands before the very judgment seat of Christ itself. And so the idea here is that upon death, a person receives the particular judgment. They receive knowledge of their destiny among the saved. Heaven is guaranteed. But in that very same moment, in standing before Christ, there is the purification. And that would still fit with saying death, then judgment, and purgatory still fitting within that equation. And this idea of purgatory being the very judgment experience itself seems to be how Paul articulates it in 1 Corinthians 3:11 through 15. The purification of the saved Christian that he describes happens on, quote unquote, the day, which for Paul is the day of judgment. Pope Benedict XVI pitched this articulation of purgatory in his 2007 encyclical Spes Savi. Here's what he writes. Quote, some recent theologians are of the opinion that the fire which both burns and saves is Christ himself. And of course, that's a reference to the fire that Paul, the image of the fire that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 3:11 through 15. So the fire with that which both burns and saves is Christ himself, the judge and savior. He goes on, the encounter with Christ is the decisive act of judgment. Before Christ's gaze, all falsehood melts away. This encounter with Christ, as it burns us, transforms and frees us, allowing us to become truly ourselves. He concludes, Christ's gaze, the touch of his heart, heals us through an undeniably painful transformation, quote unquote, quoting Paul, as through fire. That's verse 15 of 1 Corinthians chapter 3. So an appeal to judgment after death doesn't disprove purgatory because the purgatorial experience may be the experience of judgment itself. So either A, it doesn't disprove purgatory because we could say purgatory comes after judgment, we receive knowledge of our destiny, and then the final purification, or B, we can articulate purgatory as the judgment experience itself standing before Christ and all falsehood melting away. Either way we cash it out, the purgatory idea, or the doctrine of purgatory, still fits with what the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews 9:27, every human being dies once and then judgment. So there actually is room for the experience of purgatory, this postmortem final purification of the elect, with Hebrews 9:27. Okay, now the next verse that's appealed to is Luke 16:26, where Jesus tells the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And Abram tells the rich man who experiences torment, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you, from here to you may not be able and none may cross from there to us. Geisler and McKenzie argue that this text reveals two things. Number one, they state no one can cross the border into heaven after death. And two, upon death, a person goes directly to one of two destinies, heaven or hell. This is the argument that's more in keeping with the immediacy of heaven objection. And so I'm going to take each of these in turn. First, this text from Luke 16:26 only proves that no one from hell can cross the border into heaven after death. So notice Geisler McKenzie's argument. This is showing that you can't cross the border into heaven. The implication being that if you're in purgatory, you would never be able to cross the border into heaven. No, this passage only shows that somebody in hell can't cross into heaven after death. The rich man is not in purgatory, contrary to what some believe. Check out paragraph 633 of the Catechism for further details on that. The rich man is in hell, since it only shows that no one from hell can't enter heaven. It allows for the possibility that someone in purgatory could. So that's my response to the first target that Geisler McKenzie established for us in appealing to this passage. Now, as for the second argument that they make, that this text reveals people go directly to either heaven or hell upon death, the text doesn't prove this, at least not in relation to heaven. Does it show that someone who is judged at death to go to hell immediately enters hell? Yes, and we believe that. If you're judged to go to hell and you're among the damned, you immediately go to hell. But it doesn't show immediate entrance into heaven such that it would exclude purgatory. And one reason is that Lazarus is not in heaven, but in Abraham's bosom, which is simply the abode of the dead for the righteous before Christ's ascension. So Lazarus, as I mentioned earlier, still could have undergone some purification before entrance into heaven upon Christ's ascension. But even if we grant, for argument's sake, that Abraham's bosom is heaven, this text still doesn't prove immediate entrance into heaven. And the reason is that Jesus says Lazarus was, quote, carried to Abraham's bosom, close quote, which indicates an intervening process, being carried by angels before arrival at his destiny, Abraham's bosom. So we have Jesus himself encouraging us to envision for a believer an intervening process between death and the arrival at his final destiny. And at least that principle could apply to heaven when a Christian actually enters into heaven. In this case, it's Abraham's bosom, but the principle could still very well apply for a Christian when heaven is opened up for human beings. My friends, I'm coming up on my last break. Stay tuned. More to come on the other side. Well, welcome back, my friends, to our last and final segment of today's episode of The Catholic Reason, where we are looking at the general or common objection to the Catholic doctrine of purgatory that the Bible reveals upon death a Christian immediately enters into heaven. And we've looked at several passages already in today's episode. Where we left off in our last segment was Luke chapter 16, verse 26, which is part of the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. The late Norman Geisler and Ralph McKenzie in their book, Roman Catholics and Evangelicals, they appeal to this passage to support the thesis that upon death, a Christian will immediately enter into heaven. In this case, the Christian is Lazarus is paralleling the Christian, whereas those among the damned go immediately into hell after death. Now, in response, we said, number one, that Abraham's bosom, which Jesus speaks of in the parable, isn't heaven. And so this text would not automatically disprove purgatory, since, as mentioned, Lazarus could very well still have had to undergo a final purification before entrance into heaven, the beatific vision, upon Christ's ascension. Secondly, there is actually an interim period, an intermediate process of being carried to Abraham's bosom. So even if, for argument's sake, we were to map this on to post-death and then heaven for the Christian, Jesus is envisioning an intermediary process, an intermediate process of being carried to. So between death, right, and the arrival at the destiny, there's an interim period there, which could allow for a final purification of purgatory. And then, finally, a third answer. So those were the two answers we gave in our last segment. There was one more answer I wanted to give here. Even if we were to concede again that this text shows Lazarus immediately enters heaven, it still wouldn't disprove purgatory. Why? Because it's only showing that Lazarus didn't need any postmortem final purification. Like the good thief perhaps didn't need any postmortem final purification. Which fits with the Catholic teaching that it's possible for someone to bypass purgatory. And in this case, Lazarus would just simply be one example illustrating or manifesting an instance of that Catholic principle or teaching. Okay, so that completes our response to Luke 16:26. Another passage that Geisler and McKenzie appeal to in their rapid-fire manner is 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, where Paul speaks of his quote-unquote departure to receive his quote-unquote crown of righteousness. Here's the text in full. Again, this is 2 Timothy 4, 6 through 8. For I am already on the point of being sacrificed. The time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. For now on, there is laid upon me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. And not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. One might be tempted to argue that even if we grant, for argument's sake, that this text entails immediate entrance into heaven, it only proves an immediate entrance for Paul. It doesn't mean everyone will immediately enter heaven. But Paul does say, not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing. That is all the elect, the Christians. Those who are within God's providential plan will to finally persevere and go to heaven. So this route is actually blocked off for us. The route that we took in a previous example, saying one in particular, maybe not all. Well, this one, that route's blocked off to us. Now, that answer was granting the fact that this text necessitates an immediate entrance into heaven. But I don't think this is the case. That's to say, this text does not show immediate entrance into heaven. Consider the imagery that Paul uses, receiving a crown in a race. When a runner wins a race by crossing the finish line, does that mean he immediately has the crown placed on his head? The answer is no. As it was back then in ancient times and is now, there is an interim period between crossing the finish line and having the crown placed on his head. Now, Paul says he will be awarded the crown of righteousness after crossing the finish line of death. But like in the racing example, crossing the finish line doesn't necessitate an immediate reception of the crown. So that's my first reason why I do not think this text proves an immediate entrance into heaven after death for Paul. Furthermore, as I've explained already, purgatory can be envisioned as the judgment day experience itself, whether that's instantaneous or durational. So consider this, if Paul did have to undergo a final purification after death, he still could truthfully say the Lord awarded him the crown of righteousness on that day. Because you can receive a purification on that day, the day of judgment, and on that same day receive the crown of righteousness. So again, there is still room within this passage for the doctrine of purgatory. This passage from 2 Timothy chapter 4, verses 6 through 8, does not exclude the possibility of purgatory. It does not disprove the Catholic doctrine of purgatory. All right, so we got two more passages to go in this last segment. The next passage is Revelation chapter 6, verses 9 through 10, which speaks of the martyrs in heaven. We read this, "The saints who will be martyred during the great tribulation will go immediately to heaven," so Geisler and McKenzie write. So they're appealing to Revelation 6, 9 through 10, which speaks of the martyrs. And then they conclude, "The saints who will be martyred during the great tribulation will go immediately to heaven." Well, the first thing to say here is that the mere affirmation that souls are in heaven, which is what Revelation 6, 9 through 10 does, says nothing whether they immediately entered or not. For example, if I say, "I'm home after a long day at work," it doesn't follow that I immediately was home when I left work. I could have stopped at the grocery store or something, similar to the examples we gave earlier. Similarly, just because we have a revelation that souls are in heaven, it doesn't follow that they immediately entered heaven. Now, secondly, as Catholics, we agree that these souls that Revelation 6, 9 through 10 describes immediately entered into heaven. But not because they're revealed to be in heaven, which is the logic of Geisler and McKenzie's argument. That's not the reason why we think they immediately went to heaven. Rather, we say this because they're martyrs. Martyrs don't need any final purification after death. Presumably, all the remnants of sins are taken care of by their degree of love manifest in the martyrdom. Thus, they go straight to heaven. So Geisler and McKenzie's appeal to Revelation 6, 9 through 10, again, fails as a defeater of purgatory on two accounts. Affirmation of souls in heaven does not logically entail immediate entrance into heaven. And secondly, these are indeed martyrs, which we will concede that they immediately entered into heaven, but not because the Bible says they are in fact in heaven, but because they were martyrs. So I would agree that we could appeal to this passage for an immediate entrance into heaven for them, but it doesn't establish a principle of immediate entrance into heaven for all Christians, precisely because the Christians spoken of in this passage are martyrs. Okay, finally, the last text that Geisler and McKenzie appealed to on page 339 of their book is Luke 16, 22 through 24. It's the same parable of the rich man and Lazarus. However, they appeal to it here for a slightly different reason. Earlier, they appealed to the passage to show that Lazarus went immediately into heaven and that there was no crossing the border into heaven from hell. Here, at this point, they argue that this text reveals, in their words, quote, "unbelievers enter hell at the moment of death." But folks, all this shows is that unbelievers immediately enter hell after death. It says nothing about believers and their immediate entrance and arrival at their destiny. For example, suppose I tell a story in which the top three racers are promised to dine with the finest people on earth after the race. Those who don't qualify in the top three spots are immediately excluded from entering the banquet. But that doesn't mean the top three qualifiers immediately enter the banquet when they qualify. There may be an interim period between finishing the race and the banquet, maybe perhaps for the sake of freshening up and getting ready for the banquet. Similarly, saying that unbelievers immediately enter hell, mapping on with those disqualified from the banquet, doesn't have any bearing as to whether the believers immediately enter heaven, mapping on in the analogy with those who are qualified for the banquet. Thus, the rich man's immediate entrance into hell does not disprove purgatory, like Geisler and McKenzie think it does. Well, my friends, that's all the time that we have for this week's episode of The Catholic Reason. My claim today is that the immediate entry into heaven argument doesn't succeed, and all of the passages that Geisler and McKenzie appeal to fail to prove this thesis. Luke 23:43, the good thief on the cross, fails, does not prove this thesis. 2 Corinthians 5:6-8 and Philippians 1:23 do not prove this thesis. Conceptual unity, remember, does not entail simultaneity in time or in reality. Hebrews 9:27 doesn't disprove purgatory because the purgatorial experience can be articulated as the experience of the judgment itself. Luke 16:26, the immediate entrance into heaven for Lazarus, that assumes Abraham's bosom is heaven, but it's not, which would allow for the possibility of purgatory. And even if it were, it would only prove that for Lazarus, he bypassed purgatory, doesn't prove everyone else will. And then also, too, Lazarus's purification could have been instantaneous. 2 Timothy 4:6-8 does not prove immediate entrance into heaven, especially given the racing imagery that Paul utilizes there. Revelation 6:9-10, affirming souls in heaven, does not entail immediate entrance into heaven. And of course, immediate entrance into hell has no bearing on whether believers immediately enter into heaven or not. So, my friends, I invite you to join me again next week. Tell a friend. I'll talk to you then. God bless.